Now, can you plug Jesus Christ into a stage with bombs going, smoke blowing, hair teased up to the moon, in skin-tight spandex and leather, bouncing around with a bass guitar and rubbernecking while the crowd scream?
All right, welcome back to Conspiranormal. This is Adam Sane, and I have with me, unbelievably, Luke.
I made it.
That's right. How you doing, Luke?
Good, man. I'm the only one of your friends not in jail.
Well, I don't think we need to go there. Anyway, we're just going to get straight into the guest. You and I will talk a little bit later, but... I have on the line, after a round of technical difficulties for about 30 minutes, probably on both of our ends, I have Michelle Balanchet. And Michelle is describe yourself as a psychic medium, is that correct?
It is one of the titles that's given to me, yeah.
And I'd say an occultist. And Michelle, you were also in Paranormal State. The show Paranormal State that was on A&E for a while. And yep. Just kind of like to go in, if many of my guests are not familiar with you, what it is that you do and who you are.
Well, what a lot of people who've seen Paranormal State see me as is as a psychic medium. On the show, most of what you get to see me do is go frequently blindfolded into locations and rattle off my impressions of the haunting or whatever activity is going on there. But what you don't usually get to see is behind the scenes. If Paranormal State were Supernatural, I'd be Bobby without the alcoholism. Or if it were Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I'd be Giles. With maybe Spike's fashion sense. I knew the PRS crew before they had the show Paranormal State, and a lot of my work with them initially was because I'm a scholar on the occult, on myth, on folklore, on hauntings. I maintain a library of about over 3,000 books on those topics, and am a writer myself.
3,000 books.
And counting, so it's probably closer to 3,300 at this point.
Wow.
Right,
and
on.
It's nonfiction stuff, so like I've got pretty much an actual library. So there's sections on reincarnation, world mythology, world religion, folklore, psychology, ancient civilizations, ufology, the paranormal, ghosts, hauntings, poltergeists, you name it, I probably have it.
Well, you're perfect for this show then, because we've talked about all that kind of stuff on this show. Mm-hmm. I'd say just about any of that and all of it. But one of the things that we've kind of touched on a lot on this show, and it's kind of been through, I'd say, Luke's interests and some other guests that we've had on, has been kind of the occult. We've touched on that in a few different ways, conspiracy topics, talking about some people coming from like the more the Christian field perspective on it. But I wanted to get kind of, you know, as someone that is an expert on it, your perspective about what the occult is and also kind of like its significance and its history.
Well, the word occult simply means hidden, something that is in the shadows and therefore something that seems mysterious. Now, most people hear occult these days and all they hear is the second half of that. They hear occult. And they think that that means that it's, you know, big and dark and spooky and out to sacrifice goats in the woods at midnight. But the actual word occult, it shares the same root as occluded or any other word that is about what's hidden. And the history of what is the occult, especially here in Western civilization, is usually things that are a little bit outside of mainstream, whatever is at the time mainstream religion. So occult studies encompass anything that involves magic. What we call the paranormal now actually would fall under the blanket umbrella of occult, at least in past decades. It can range in everything from the study of demons and demonology and the any of the practices from ancient times onward that involve binding, banishing, or otherwise dealing with demons and other spiritual entities, as well as any other practice of magic, ceremonial magic, ritual, etc. Again, it's anything that's outside of the boundaries of what we accept as normal religious expression of, you know, supernatural experiences.
What's kind of like kind of some of the history of it? Where does the occult come from? I know that that's kind of a multifaceted question because you're dealing with like more like a series of beliefs than you are dealing with like one overarching.
But well, if I had to say, I think the easiest way to answer that would be to start where does magic in the Western world, our idea of an actual real practice of magic, so practices that allow us to deal with spirits, whether they are demonic or benign, as well as angels, any sort of practice that allows people to exert their will upon the world around them, either through incantations, spells, or simply the exercise of their will. If we want to trace that part of the Western tradition all the way back, we would have to go to Sumer, Babylon, and Akkad in the cradle of civilization. So at the very beginning of what we understand as Western civilization, as soon as humanity could write things down, while there were religious rituals for dealing with the gods, there were also rituals and magical practices for dealing with everything else. Spirits, demons, and all of the weird things that walk around in the shadows and, you know, just outside of the bounds of what's accepted. And if I had to give you a blanket answer of, like, where what we understand as the occult now started, it was in those practices of dealing with all the things that laid outside the bounds. Now, in ancient Sumer, Babylon, and Akkad, this actually started off as stuff that priests, there were priesthoods that were dedicated to dealing with all of this weird stuff. And over time, what happens is there is the accepted, organized religious approach, and then the practices get in the hands of other people who are not necessarily trained within the priesthood and therefore not necessarily controlled by the organized religion. And those tend to be the people who are identified more as sorcerers or wizards and are perceived as practicing the occult, the hidden doctrine, the hidden practices. Now, these things are not one single thread. You're not going to be able to open a book anywhere in the world and find, you know, the magical occult practices that were in place back in, like, ancient Babylon that have been handed down over generations to us unchanged. That simply doesn't exist. But there are definitely traditions that have grown out of various cultures and have been handed down, or at least have influenced other beliefs over time. So you have the Sumerian and Babylonian way of dealing with what they believed to be demons, spirits that were more powerful than regular humans, but a little bit less powerful than the gods. Many times they were believed to come from the gods, and they had a very involved way of dealing with them, binding them, protecting people from them, identifying their influence in people's lives, to the ceremonial magic that was practiced in predominantly Christian Western Europe, and oh my goodness, from like the 12th century onward, in texts like the Heptameron, things like the Solomonic tradition, and again, really, it's a huge, complicated blanket term for anything that was a little beyond the bounds of what people accepted as mainstream, organized, ordered, and controlled ways of dealing with the supernatural.
Right. How much does role does like paganism and animism play in kind of like the formation of the occult?
Modern pagans practice a religion which is in part inspired by ancient practices like shamanism and animism, where the world was believed to be peopled with spirits and intelligences. In a sense, you know, that ancient world for non-monotheistic religions was a world that was alive. Everything was alive and everything was sacred. Now, again, it's not that there was a single thread of tradition and belief that was handed down over the centuries, so much as there are myths and we tell stories of these ancient times, and we've had differing understandings of exactly what people were doing. And once we get to the modern era where paganism really started, modern paganism really started, people looked back at those stories, at those practices, usually from starting from an academic or a scholarly standpoint, and adapted them to modern practice, modern belief. Modern neopaganism, it really is a 20th century religion. The roots are right in the 1800s, and arguably as far back as the 1700s. However, it does not have... what modern pagans practice is not something that was practiced millennia ago. It's their take on it. That being said, there are beliefs in magic, and magical practices are part of most modern pagan traditions. And by definition, some of those practices are identified by others as occult. Again, because it's a secret tradition. It's stuff that not everybody understands, and it's stuff that is not necessarily part of what the rest of society accepts as mainstream religion, which, you know, for most people, mainstream religion begins and ends with Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Maybe with a nod to Buddhism and the Asian traditions, but, you know, for folks here in the Western world, those get pretty esoteric. And the line between magic and religion and philosophy and spirituality in Asian religions are quite different, much hazier than they are when we're talking about the mainstream religions inspired by the Bible and the biblical tradition.
Mm-hmm. So in the Eastern tradition, it's a lot of that stuff is not hidden. It's pretty in the mainstream, like Hinduism and Buddhism.
A lot of the practices that we would identify here in the West as magic, and therefore something that many people would identify as a cult, go hand in hand with a great deal of the standard practices. So take, for instance, Hinduism, where yoga. We practice yoga here in the West, and we've kind of like sanitized it by removing it from the root religious belief from whence it comes. But it's a mystical practice. It's a spiritual practice where you become aware of the prana, the life force that moves through your body, your ability to manipulate it, your ability to harness it so that your body can do things beyond what is normally accepted as you know, a human limitation. And there were, especially in like the 1800s, as you know, folks from the West were starting to explore and discover these practices, we saw them as almost like wizards, the kind of stuff that they could do through this practice. And so it seems very magical from our perspective, but it's just how things were. It's how that religion approaches body, mind, and spirit.
Now, when you say the word magic, and I know this is probably a question that you get a lot, the differentiation between magic with a K and the magic of like a magician, showman does. Yeah, I know Luke knows the answer to this question, but what's kind of the difference between those? What's the definitions of magic with a K as opposed to, you know, magic with a C?
Magic just with a C is prestidigitation and sleight of hand. Magic that is established through nothing supernatural or paranormal or psychic. It is pretty much smoke and mirrors. And it would be the magic of Harry Houdini, the magic of David Copperfield, and the magic of Chris Angel.
Yeah.
So there's nothing... And they do not claim that there is anything supernatural or extraordinary going on. They are using their ability to misdirect to make it seem like they are casting illusions and doing amazing things that are magic with a K. And Aleister Crowley was the fellow who really instituted this usage to differentiate the practice of exerting human will either on the self, the body, or on the world around the person in order to enact significant changes which anybody else is going to identify as supernatural or paranormal in nature, something that seems to be above and beyond the ability we would ordinarily attribute to someone in a purely material way. So when a pagan practices magic with a K, they may ask for, say they cast a prosperity spell. And it's interesting, as I'll explain this, for anybody in the audience who happens to be of a more religious bent, like a Christian bent, it's going to sound like the pagan is praying. Light a candle, decide what your intent is, go through sometimes just writing out your intent. You express it with words, with actions, with symbols, in order to focus your will, and then try to bring about a change in the world, which is possibly, you know, a break in a job interview that just, you know, happens to come your way the next day after you cast the spell. For a Christian, it's prayer, and God is the one who's answering that. For a pagan or anybody else who practices magic with a K, it doesn't negate their belief in a higher power, but magic is when you are doing it yourself. Your will, your power, your ability to bring these changes in the world, and that is magic.
You'd mentioned a few minutes ago about old pagan traditions and new pagan traditions and the difference between them. How do they practice different today versus pre-1700s?
Well, pre-1700s, there used to be, actually there was a very big debate, scholarly-wise, of whether or not these things were actually handed down, like, you know, from mother to daughter or father to son, from the ancient ways, the old ways. Very, very early paganism, not the modern practice, but what you might have found practiced in small villages in pre-Christian or even early Christian Europe is very tied to nature, to the seasons. It is very tied to the harvest, as well as to finding ways in the natural world to harness the powers that be, to harness the powers of the plants or the rocks, the roots, and the natural forces, and to channel those into change, healing, health, fertility, and ways of trying to benefit yourself or your community. Now, there are so many different pantheons and names of gods and goddesses based on each time and each region that it would take us an entire radio show, several of them,
right.
But the main thing, and it is and it is not different, the main thing is that connection to earthly powers that are more than just dust and dirt, and an inherent knowing on the part of the practitioner, which in Middle Ages Europe might have been called a witch, or a cunning woman, or a cunning man. In other cultures, might have been called a medicine man, and in other cultures, might be a shaman. But someone who can speak to the spirits, and who can speak to the power in things, and find a way to harness that to affect those changes. Now, over time, practices were lost or suppressed, as Christianity particularly spread through Europe. In the Western world, a lot of these practices either were actively rooted out, or they became something that was married with the Christian expression. We don't necessarily think of that so much in the traditions that might have been passed down to us by, say, you know, our Eastern European grandmothers or our Irish grandmothers and grandfathers. But we really get to see how a native tradition that has strong magical and very pagan elements can get married to a Christian tradition. If you look at voodoo, Kandomble, Santeria, any of the African diaspora religions, where in voodoo, it is the Loas, which for folks who are not into voodoo, I can best... A down and dirty definition of the Loas are ancestor spirits with a vengeance, with an attitude. they're sassy, they're very present in the world, they're still very human in a lot of their ways of dealing with people, but they're also superpowered. They have the ability to affect these changes, and you deal with them to help you bring things in. And in voodoo, they connect them, they syncretize them with Catholic saints. And so if you walked in on a voodoo altar and you didn't know the other little signs of what you were looking at, it could pass for a Catholic altar to a particular saint, so that it wouldn't be routed out. So, you know, people wouldn't be burned or punished for practicing something that wasn't strictly Christian.
Yes. That went on a lot from the time that the Catholic Church took over till even till today, that a lot of they just really absorbed, because they would baptize people en masse, and they just absorbed a lot of those beliefs into Catholicism.
Well, it's why Irish Catholics have a particular flavor to them, and there's particular saints that are very specific to that tradition. Saint Bridget or Breed. There's a great story that explains why she's really a saint, but she was just an Irish goddess, and they weren't willing to give her up. Yeah. And so she became the wet nurse to Jesus. And she's not technically... She is a saint, but she was a goddess first. And she's a really good example for how you have a pagan tradition that survives in Christianity, and has survived so well that people don't necessarily even know that there is a pagan goddess underneath St. Bridget's veil.
Right. Or even the Virgin Mary herself is kind of a cover for different goddesses of the ancient Near East.
Sophia being the Gnostics. I definitely see a lot of the iconography with Mary getting married to Sophia, who was a goddess of wisdom and in some traditions the wife of God. Basically, the idea that you've got this very, very masculine patriarchal deity, and he doesn't have a counterpart, he doesn't have a female counterpart. Mary, for many people, answers the need for a goddess in the Christian tradition, especially in the Catholic tradition.
Right.
I mean, the very pagan elements of Catholicism are at the foundation of the split between Catholicism and Protestantism. The saints, all the iconography, all the many high holy days, the very magical aspect of the ritual in the Mass, transubstantiation of wine and bread into blood and flesh.
One of the two things that the occult is often, I think, confused with is New Age and Satanism. And
Satanism, definitely, yeah. Keep going.
Yeah. What's kind of the difference between New Age and the occult?
Before she answers that real quick, that would be my difference. Where I was talking about the pre-pagan practice versus nowadays pagan practice is the introduction of the New Age stuff. And of course, like the Dark Ages, like she was talking about, Christianity come through, changed everything. But, you know, that for me was the difference between what's practiced now and then was
older
kind of
versus newer.
The introduction of these New Age traditions with the pagan traditions.
Well, yeah, because modern paganism is a very self-aware religion. It's a very self-aware practice. It borrows from everything it can get its hands on. So you'll see elements now in modern pagan practice of Buddhism, Hinduism, of a lot of more modern New Age ideas that have been developed in the past 100 or 200 years.
Right.
The difference between occult and pagan, and occult and New Age, and occult and Satanism sometimes is purely in the eye of the person defining what is occult. And that's the hard part, is since we've got this word that is a big blanket term for everything that is hidden or dark or mysterious, because it's so ambiguous, it's very easy to lump a lot of things in there. Now, if you're talking about the people who practice these things within their communities, they make sharp distinctions. New Agers do not necessarily like to be considered pagan. Pagans do not necessarily like to be considered New Agers. And neither New Agers nor pagans like to be considered Satanists. They have clear and sharp defining lines. Not all pagans practice the type of magic that we often associate with the occult, which tends to be much more... the pagan magic is much more natural. It can be almost mistaken for prayer. And you know, if you line it up side by side, it often involves gods and goddesses. It often involves pretty much the same steps that a Christian will go through to pray. Lighting candles, saying intentions, invoking higher powers. Whereas not all occult practices that would be identified as magic will necessarily have anything to do with a god or goddess or a religious tradition. It's more about harnessing the power that comes from within a person, either through ceremony, through incantation, through symbols, or simply by sitting and willing it to be. And sometimes it really depends on the trappings. Now, again, it would take probably scores and scores of podcasts to talk about the finer points. But New Age is first a movement toward more a personal spirituality as opposed to an organized religion. And in some respects, it is a reaction against organized religion. While they don't necessarily all realize it, New Agers have a lot in common with old Christian Gnostics, who the Gospel of Thomas was a big part of the Gnostic tradition, where rather than going to a church to find God, you would find God within. You would find your own path. And you would, rather than have a priest tell you how to practice, you would seek practice yourself. You would seek the truth yourself. Now, on top of that, the New Age practices have gotten... I don't want to say muddled, but they have added in ideas of a grand awakening, the age of Aquarius. There's a fair amount of psychic awakening, psychic practices that are part of the New Age tradition.
Mm-hmm. Crystal magic.
New Agers would not identify what they do as magic, whereas a pagan is comfortable with that term. Although if you kind of like peel it back and really look at what they're doing, they're all doing the same darn thing.
Right, kind of like prime.
It's also
like
it's so hard to define any of it. And then to make it even harder, there's theistic Satanism, which may or may not be real. And theistic Satanism is supposedly those people who believe in Satan, Lucifer, the devil, as a real, powerful entity who by nature... is the antithesis of God.
Right.
And theistic Satanists, in theory, worship that figure with the intent of working against all that God and God's traditional religions represent.
These are all now, the death metal bands that Luke listens to.
Not quite.
Now, I have a hard time thinking of anybody who would seriously want to pitch for what ultimately is a losing team, because to be a theistic Satanist, you have to essentially buy into Christianity first.
That's funny, right?
Up against
it's true.
It.
It's true.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, God is real, Christ is real, and you totally just want to undermine all of that. And that is theistic Satanism.
A bunch of crybabies who just saying that they... trying to show everyone how much they hate it.
I think a lot of it's done for shock.
Yeah.
Really.
See, that's the thing. That's why I'm kind of skeptical, because every time I have been pointed in the direction of someone who either thinks that there's, like, actual Satanism going on over in this place. It turns out to be, like, you know, some 15, 16-year-olds who watched too many bad B-movies or were listening to too many heavy metal things and really are making a show of it. They don't necessarily even really believe in what they're doing. They're just right. kind of trying to piss off mom and dad.
Yeah. That's kind of now, the...
There's a difference between that and LaVeyan Satanism, the Church of Satan is founded by Anton Zander LaVey, which actually at its core is more atheistic than it is anything else. LaVeyan Satanism is more a philosophy of you get one shot, you're here, the physical world is what is real, and your purpose is to make yourself happy. And you're not going to fulfill that purpose by bowing to anybody else's dogma or being afraid of some big old guy with a beard and a bathrobe sitting on a cloud. And that is sort of LaVeyan Satanism in a silly nutshell.
Yeah. It still didn't keep Anton LaVey from hamming it up on Rosemary's Baby.
I would just think of him as just hedonist, you know, just... Don't, whatever they're feeling at the moment right. is just what they do, no matter who it affects around them.
Right. So, Michelle, as you're in your field as an occultist, and then as a paranormal investigator, as a psychic medium, how do you use what you've learned from the occult in that field?
Well, when you're doing an investigation of a haunting, oftentimes the occult is... an important element, because either the family has run into something that they think is weird, like and it often turns out to be something that doesn't mean anything at all in the end, or is not as scary as they think it is. So, okay, family moves into a house, they start having phenomenon, and they hear from the neighbors that the people who lived there three families ago were really weird, and there was occult stuff going on in the house, and they make the association then that maybe those people who were practicing occult, whatever it was, are the ones that got the house haunted in the first place.
Sure.
And my role is to then assess, okay, so what was this occult thing that these weird people were supposedly doing? Now, as someone who has studied, again, occultism being a huge blanket for everything that is that stuff we don't understand. I mean, really, if I had to define the occult right now, that's what it comes down to. It's not mainstream religion, and it doesn't look like what we're used to, so it must be a cult. So I assess, what were the people practicing? Are there symbols? Are there ritual tools? If I can track down what it was they were practicing, or if they were like those, you know, 17-year-old kids who were just kind of putting on a show to piss off mom and dad... you can get a better handle on, you know, is this an element of the haunting? Because there are magical practices, there are rituals, there are traditions that allow you to summon spirits, to work with spirits, even to bind them to places and to objects, sometimes harmlessly, and sometimes with the intent of causing chaos and harm. But there are so many different traditions and so many different ways to doing it. It requires a fairly encyclopedic knowledge to identify it, as well as the willingness to acknowledge that the tradition's meaning, a lot of that has to do with what the person practicing it thought those symbols meant. A good example would be, there's a book out there called The Necronomicon. The truth about The Necronomicon is it was dreamed up by a very creative author, H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And created from whole cloth. It didn't exist before. But there are several things that have been peddled as the Necronomicon since, because he created such a great mystique around this forbidden book of black magic. However, if you believe hard enough in anything, the very nature of magic being harnessing human will through actions and words and symbols to create an effect in the world, if you really, really believe that that copy of the Necronomicon that you found in your grandfather's basement is an actual book of black magic, if you use it with enough intent, you can stir stuff up. Some spirits will be more than happy to let you call them Cthulhu, if that's what rocks your boat. As long as you're giving them attention, they'll come stand up and go, "Rawr," and sometimes linger in a place. So a lot of my occult knowledge is assessing what went on, what really went on.
Yeah.
Was it something that had an effect to the haunting, to what the family is experiencing? Or is it just urban legend? Is it just rumor? Is it just neighbors who were looking at perfectly harmless pagan rituals or perfectly harmless, heck, sometimes it's even Catholic rituals. I worked at a hotel where the staff completely wigged out because we had some migrant workers who were Mexican,
yeah.
And they walked into the room that they were staying in, and there were these candles and this weird stuff, and they didn't know what the heck was going on, so they brought it up to me, and the poor fellow was doing a novena. A 9-day prayer cycle that you do with a special type of candle, and it's perfectly Catholic tradition. It's part of that, you know, bit where in Mexican Catholicism there's a little bit of magic and paganism that leaked in too, but it wasn't, in the eyes of the practitioner, magical, weird, occult, or anything beyond part of his actual faith.
Right.
So I assess.
It's good that you're there to dispel some ignorance.
Yeah.
But the 16 or 17-year-old kids that are out there trying to piss mom and dad off, could they actually do a ritual and actually bring something through accidentally?
It is possible, yes. And that's where it gets tricky, because magic is about channeling human will. Everybody has the power to enact change. Everybody can draw things and invite things in if they're focused enough. And if you get somebody, I mean, 9 times out of 10, the kids who are, like, trying to pretty much, you know, horse around aren't going to cause any harm beyond they leave stuff behind that scares people because they don't know what they're looking at.
Yeah.
And then every once in a while you have somebody who's got some latent ability. And, you know, they might be dabbling with this stuff because they don't have any other way of expressing it. It might be purely accidental. They might just have the bad fortune of doing their little silly horseplay in a location that is very rich with potential activity. And it will vary from thing to thing and situation to situation. It's why it's so hard when I get, like, emails or the type of contacts, like on Facebook, and people want me to assess their haunting without me being there. There's so many little details that have to be studied because each case is absolutely different. But the bottom line is, yes, sometimes people can do it accidentally.
Sure.
You know, I got plenty of questions for you.
I'm happy to talk. As you can tell, I will talk your ear off about this topic. My only rule is there's, for so much of this, there's no easy answer. I mean, if there was a big book that could define to you exactly what the occult is and, like, outline every single knowable occult tradition, that would be amazing. I would own that book instead of a library with 3,000 books and counting.
Well, Luke's reading this tome right now. Tell her.
I'm trying to read the complete works of the Golden Dawn right now and the 3 books of occult philosophy, and man, it's heavy.
it's intense stuff, and all of their work contributed to modern 20th century and 21st century practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that's difficult with any of these occult traditions is they are constantly evolving, because each new generation, each new culture, each new belief system that gets added into it. Adds little pieces and takes little pieces away. So it's this very
ever-changing conglomeration.
Yeah, well, we're at the root of it is humans change things with language and symbol and will, and ritual helps to focus.
Right.
I think that's probably the biggest blanket I can state about, like, occult tradition. And then the actual symbols that are used, the words that are used, and the rituals that are used will vary over time and over culture, as well as from individual to individual.
So what I wanted to ask you about is necromancy. It lists it in the book a couple times. It just mentions it, but it never goes into any kind of actual practice.
So you're talking about the magical practice of working with the dead.
More specifically, using either dead animals or people, animals preferably, to scry with.
Okay, necromancy is from necro and mantia. Necro for the dead, mantia for divination. These days, when you hear necromancy, like, and it's like portrayed in TV or movies, it's like resurrecting the dead, and it might lead to zombies and vampires and God knows what. Now, that's the fictional portrayal of it, but the root of it was a divination technique with the dead. So, in Agrippa's three books of occult philosophy, there's like about a paragraph about necromancy, where he talks about certain practices of necromancy that use the physical pieces of the dead, sometimes whole bodies, in order to either draw spirits into the corpse to then act as an oracle, to speak about things. This was founded on the old belief that actually kind of lays at the heart of modern spiritualism, that when someone dies, when their spirit crosses over, they become privy to a level of understanding the world and the universe that we don't necessarily have when we are just in our life. That the dead, that the spirits of the dead, after going through a certain transformation, that they get it. They know more than we know. And exactly how much spirits of the dead know and understand and are privy to varies from culture to culture and time to time. But it was believed that they were able to see more than we could as living beings. And so they were sought out. Some of that goes back to the ancient Greeks would practice something called dream incubation, where they would seek the spirits of the dead, as well as gods, as well as demigods, in the realm of dream to answer questions for them. And that type of necromancy, which I believe Agrippa calls white necromancy, which only dealt with the spirits and not with the physical parts of the dead. Now, of course, when we're talking about, you know, that class of people who like really ooky spooky stuff, and you go, oh my goodness, you can do rituals that involve corpses and bones and stuff? How cool is that? For that class of people, there definitely are some books over the years that I think might have been written in the in the spirit of let's piss off mom and dad and seem really scary, because there's one, the Red Dragon Grimoire, I think, comes to mind. And if I'm remembering the ritual that I read correctly, it requires you to go, and mind you, on Christmas Eve, I believe, you're supposed to break into a cemetery, dig up a corpse with your bare hands, and then go throw the bones at the altar at the midnight mass. I'm not making this up. This exists in a book.
sounds like a good time.
Well, but if you think about it, there couldn't be anybody who had actually performed this ritual, whether it worked or had any founding in anything beyond how ridiculous or how scary or how offensive can I write this thing to be?
Right.
At the dead of winter, anywhere in Western Europe, please show me how anybody is going to dig a grave up with their bare hands. 6 feet down from the time the sun goes down till midnight mass to get bones of some corpse to go toss in a church.
Well...
So unfortunately, there's a lot of confusion of necromantic works that do exist. Like, if you can find necromantic rituals, it's one of those things that really qualifies as like deep occult, because the practice is so hidden and so ooky spooky that if you find something, chances are it's written by someone who never had any actual knowledge of the real practice.
Right.
Lucan, a Roman writer, he gave us probably the most of what we understand about how necromancy in the ancient world might have possibly been practiced, but at the same time, he's writing fiction. So the type of necromancer that Agrippa might have been aware of is his witch, Lucan's witch Erechtho, who resurrects a dead soldier on the battlefield to have him prognosticate, to have him, to talk to his spirit. And she goes through all of this, you know, great grand rigmarole. And while it is written by Lucan as fiction, that styling of that particular ritual becomes something that people in Europe then look to, assuming that that's how it was practiced.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
The difficult thing is you actually see more accurate necromancy in the Odyssey. Again, it's a work of fiction by Homer, and this is Greek as opposed to Roman, but Odysseus sits down and summons the spirits of the dead from Hades to ask some very important questions of one of them. And Homer probably did a very good job of describing this particular ritual. He didn't need... Odysseus doesn't need the bones of the dead. He just needs their names, and he makes offerings. And the final offering is of blood, because the life is what the dead crave. But the other offerings that he creates, this little trench around his little work area, are offerings that were traditionally given to the dead in religious ceremonies. And this is where you see that weird line between religion and the occult. Because, you know, from our perspective, when we see this ritual that Odysseus engages in to summon the souls of the dead, he's not a priest. He's not doing this as part of a religious ceremony. He's doing this for his personal gain. And it's a very chilling passage in the Odyssey. But at the same time, the ritual that he uses is a priestly ritual. It is a religious ritual that would have involved offerings given to the spirits of the dead to honor them, to help them on their passage. So I think if I had to, and I've gone far afield and right back to the what is the occult, if I had to give you the best definition of what we understand as occult practice now, it's when the role and the power of a priest or a religious ritual is taken into the hands of a layperson, a regular practitioner, and is used for, if not necessarily personal gain, then personal direction, taken outside of religion and still practiced.
I'd like to ask you, because you had mentioned something, you're talking about the ritual where you have to dig in the ground and that it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of almost like that person is trolling in a way.
There are a number of things that were definitely people trolling. And it's really important to understand Satanism and occultism and all of these things became really, like, almost fashionable, especially in France, in the 1700s toward the turn of the century. And so you will find... And it was something that people would play around with. Ben Franklin was part of the Hellfire Club, which we still can't be sure whether or not it was an actual occult organization or if it was an organization of people who were just having fun with people and basically trolling them by making it seem like, you know, there was crazy stuff going on when all they were doing were buggering servant girls down in the caves.
Well, one I was going to ask about, and one that... Aleister Crowley seemed like a lot of stuff that he did was not entirely serious. He seemed to be the king of the trolls in a way.
Well, he is a very complicated person because on one hand, he really, really understood what he was doing with magic. On the other hand, I think he figured out that nobody got it, or at least very few people got it, and most people were going to always look at him as a charlatan or a fool, and so he might as well just drop his drawers and moon everybody. And so he mixes a lot of tomfoolery, a lot of flamboyant, I don't want to say fakery, but he really would play up the role of the great beast to the people who would mistake his magic for magic with a C as opposed to magic with a K.
Yeah. as a way to, and I think Jack Parsons did that as well. Or, you know, brought him up, Jack Parsons.
Or possibly even just a way to misdirect people that don't have the perseverance that's required to study his works.
I think that there's a little bit of that too. Actually, if you get into some of the OTO stuff that Crowley wrote, he's challenging you to look beyond the superficial language, and that's an old tradition. Alchemy is probably the one that's most notorious for it, where you have all this really complicated, crazy, flowery language and symbolism, and you know the red and the black and the union of opposites and the marriage of the sun and the lion eating the lady, and just there's all these crazy images that make no sense at all unless you know what they each represent. And so you kind of have to be initiated and educated in the system to read between the lines. And if you're not, it just looks like a whole bunch of gobbledygook or a bunch of just, you know, ridiculous nonsense, at which point you go, why would anybody ever believe in or practice this?
Mm-hmm. Right.
When, you know, a lot of the alchemical stuff that they're talking about that they have put into the metaphors of, you know, things devouring other things and hermaphrodites giving birth to things are chemical reactions between, you know, and they're very real chemical reactions. So alchemy gave rise to modern chemistry.
I believe, too, that it gave rise in many ways to Freemasonry. Do you consider Freemasonry kind of an occult organization?
Oh, yeah.
Well, the Freemasons wouldn't consider themselves a cult, I don't think. However, yes, there's a lot. There is an element of ritual and the esoteric. There's definitely a hidden element to their practices. Now, the Freemasons themselves see ties to both the Templars as well as back to the Temple of Solomon. And so they're part of the Solomonic tradition. Now, I don't know any Freemason well enough to pick their brain and find out whether or not at the higher levels of initiation they don't play around with you know, Solomonic magic, which is at the core of ceremonial magic in Western Europe. That kind of stuff that deals with the Goetia and, you know, summoning and binding demons. I mean, most people don't know that, you know, biblical King Solomon, who was, you know, the wisest man, has this whole tradition around him that in Arabic countries is tied to the jinn, to genies, and in Western Europe became tied to demons, where Solomon had the ability to compel and bind these spirits. And in the Testament of Solomon, he uses them to help him build the temple. So the great sacred temple was built not merely through by human hands, but by all of these spirits that he was able to control because God had given him the power to do so and had given him a special ring that they would have to bow before.
Speaking of that, about demons, and I believe this kind of goes into it, what was your kind of purpose in writing the Dictionary of Demons?
The very core purpose, the first flash of inspiration, actually came from a conversation between me and Father Bob. We were between cases, and we were sitting in the lobby of the hotel. It was after the part where, like, I'd already come in and done my psychic thing, so I could actually talk to people, because if I was the psychic on the case, I pretty much had to, like, hide from everybody, talk to no one, and then go blindfolded in the case so I didn't taint anything. So we're hanging around, and I think we started talking about the Malleus Maleficarum. And Father Bob had asked to borrow some of the stuff that I have in my library because he didn't have ready access to some of it. And then I found out that my Latin might be a little bit better than Father Bob's was at the time. So, and also he didn't have access to things like the Testament of Solomon or the Lamegaton and the various grimoires from the Solomonic tradition, the Pseudo Monarchia Demonum. And I started rattling off all of these things, and his eyes got bigger and bigger. He's like, "What are these books?" And I'm like, "They're from the ceremonial tradition in Europe, probably, well, mainly between like the 12th and the 17th centuries, and most of them deal with demons. And there are names and names and names. And if you're familiar with the Roman ritual and with traditional Catholic exorcism, the name of the demon is fairly important. That goes back to biblical tradition. And actually, the biblical tradition goes all the way back to the Sumerian and Babylonian tradition, where the name not only summons the spirit, but also gives you the power to command and compel and bind it. So working from that idea that names have power, and that the names of demons allow one to banish and exorcise them, I started to pour through all of the texts that I could get my hands on that I knew to look for, and identified every spirit that within those texts were either called demons, evil spirits, or fallen angels. Anything that didn't fall under that, I cut out, because otherwise I would have had to write like 5 volumes. I mean, it's a ridiculous number of things, and I got all their proper names and I put them together in one place. Now, it wouldn't be complete without also getting the names of demons that are traditionally identified as demons within the Bible and the biblical tradition and things connected with it, as well as sort of like looking at how some of those have come to be seen as demons, because not all of them started off as demons within the cultures that originally worshipped them as gods, like Baal, B-A-A-L, sometimes spelled B-A-E-L, Baal. Didn't start off as a demon. He was a god worshipped by people who were antagonistic with the ancient Israelites. And so the god of the Bible was a rival to Baal, or Baal was a rival to the god of the Bible, and therefore any god that was worshipped by a group of people who were warring with or struggling against the Israelites, who had a different religion, their gods automatically got turned into demons. And so all of those are also in the Dictionary of Demons, as well as sort of like the little history of like how that name came about, how they came to be seen as demons, as well as fallen angels, not all of whom necessarily were cast from heaven, at least not according to the texts. There's the Watcher angels who, depending on the source material, either ended up here on Earth as kind of a bargain with God, where they were like, hey, humans are screwing things up on your little planet, let us go down and fix it for you, Dad. And God says, you're going to get messed up if you go down there. And the angels say, no, we can handle it. And he lets them go. Mind you, they're not cast out, but the very nature of being here is what corrupts them. Or they just chose to walk out of heaven because they just wanted to be here more. So all of those different spirits. And their stories, which are really what's important to me. And then the final part about the Dictionary of Demons is I wanted to stick to the scholarship, the academic approach to the stories, the myths, and the beliefs around these things, rather than the theological implication of, you know, are they real? Are they not real? Are they fallen? What does that mean? That I leave up to people of different religious traditions, because that is not my territory. I just looked through books and reported what was in the books.
So you don't have like any like overarching belief onto what demons are, just more, maybe more of a, you look at it kind of a more of a scholarly way?
Well, I have my belief, but when you're talking a tradition that is so hotly debated and can be such a knee-jerk button for some people,
right.
I felt my personal beliefs about these things need to be kept separate from just the scholarship of here is the tradition of demons in the Western world. Now, there's my interpretive belief, and then there's stuff that I've gotten to see in the field. And I have to say my interpretive belief is informed by my scholarship. You know, I don't necessarily believe in, the straight-up idea of Christian demons, that they're all fallen angels, that there's, you know, this grand struggle for people's soul between heaven and hell. It's not quite like that. I accept that people call spirits that are intelligent malevolent, non-human in origin, and very antagonistic toward humanity. Like, they need to have those qualities for me to identify them as demons.
Okay.
What they really are in the grand scheme of things, I try not to debate, but I have encountered things that it's wicked smart. It doesn't seem like it was ever human, and it has a very inhuman kind of alien quality to its intelligence. It does not have a sense of good and evil like we do, and in fact, actually, it's fairly malevolent by nature, and it really just seems to delight in messing with regular people, living people. And when it fits those four criteria, I'm like, well, every other culture has recognized weird stuff like this too, and the best word we have for it is demon. Whether or not that means it crawled out of hell or some trans-dimensional rift, I don't care. At the end of the day, what I really want to do, if I'm on a case, is to get it to leave people alone.
Right.
I got one for you about the Kabbalah.
Okay.
So there's this whole story, I think, from the Zohar about the origin of the original Arabic language, like the pure Arabic language. And the, 22 letters? And I'm wondering where the numerical values came from that were assigned to the letters.
I do not know where the numbers came from. I just know that each letter is a number. And the numerical value of the letters informs the... It's the basis of our idea of Western numerology. And it's also the basis of a tradition called Gematria, where in, especially like the Old Testament, or what Christians call the Old Testament, each of those words, every single word, is almost a code as well. The idea that the beast, that the devil, or, whatever, has a number, and although 666 apparently is not the accurate one, that meaning... of numbers is very tied in with that language. It is possible, and this is pure conjecture on my part, the very roots of language, as it is understood now, at least in the West, ties to Sumer. Again, a lot of things on our side of the planet seem to go back to Sumer, Babylon, and Akkad, the cradle of civilization. It's where we recognize, it's where scholars recognize is like the start of agriculture, the start of organized religion. It's pretty much, for what we understand of our core culture, it all ties back to that place. And let me say that that place is modern-day Iraq. Hotly debated location.
Yes.
Language started there as a way of counting. First, people would just make little hash marks, little symbols, little impressions in clay to count the stuff that they had, to count their sheep, to count their grain, how many jars of whatever thing that they had. And as they started to get like larger numbers, they would have more complicated symbols to represent 10 and 60 and 360 and such like that. And then when this actually started first as little tokens. So actually let me move back. So they had little tokens that represented the things that they would count. And the little tokens eventually got stuck into so that they wouldn't lose them, like these almost like little pies. It's like little clay pockets. Mm. And they would stamp what was inside the clay pocket once they sealed it, and they were done with the counting. And over time, they realized that if they were marking the little symbols into the clay pocket to represent the items that were stored in the clay pocket that represented the things that they were counting, well, they might as well just do away with the little tokens and the clay pocket entirely, have a flat piece of clay, and just use the symbols, just use the impression of the token that counted 1, 10, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And that became language. Eventually, it turned into language. So counting and language are, on a certain level, almost inextricable. interestingly, this is one thing I got corrected on, and it was a good correction. It's a correction to keep in mind. The Kabbalah, a fundamental part of the Kabbalah is the Tree of Life, and it has the Sephira in it. And I had been told, and the Golden Dawn tradition defines the Sephira as jewels, and I believe it was Israel Regardi's stuff, Jewels on the Tree, where he connected the word Sephiroth with sapphire. When actually the root word is counting, is numbers, which I find very significant to the topic. So symbol and number, letter and number, I don't know where reasonably those connections were made, but those connections run very, very deep in the Western tradition, and the meanings assigned to those numbers are something that you will find at the core of many magical and occult traditions.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
Anything you wanted to ask, Luke?
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you the time that we got remaining, Michelle. I've heard you describe yourself as a psychic vampire, or the concept of psychic vampirism. Can you kind of go over what exactly that is?
Down and dirty definition, a psychic vampire is a person who needs to regularly and actively take human vital energy in order to maintain their own health and well-being. Simply put, everybody is, by my perception, a being of both body and spirit, body and energy. And we can measure this thing that we call energy, and I'm using air quotes, you just can't see me using air quotes. We measure that with things like galvanic skin response, biophotons, there's so many different ways, EEGs and EKGs, our bodies are run on electricity, so think of that biological charge.
Sure.
Different world religions call it, or world traditions call it, you know, chi, prana, and it's all connected with breath, life, energy. So, first off, everybody has it. Everybody exchanges it with their environment as well as with one another to one extent or another. Every conversation, every time you kiss somebody, every time you have a meaningful interaction with someone, there is a connection and a flow of energy and power that comes from person to person. Some people, performers, seem to have an ability to harness that, like the ones that have like a really strong presence, strong charisma. We talk without really thinking about what it means when we encounter someone who has good energy or bad energy. It's part of our language, but we don't necessarily attribute anything weird to it. Well, a psychic vampire is someone who, for one reason or another, is tuned into this energy, and also has a need, a natural inborn ability, to meet that need, to take it from other people. There are an awful lot of psychic vampires who are not aware of what they're doing, and probably will never be aware of what they're doing. They're just not conscious of it, and they find the most efficient and oftentimes most obtrusive ways of getting what they need. Getting a strong emotional response from somebody, really like getting them to getting up in their face, or kind of getting their sympathy, but anything that pulls their attention to you is a pathway to start to connect their energy and take their energy. And everybody's got that one friend, relative, or really frenemy. When you interact with them, you feel drained when you're done. You feel like they've taken something from you. You can even kind of put your finger on exactly when they're doing it. And whether they realize it or not depends on whether or not you want to tolerate them or just get them the heck out of your life.
True.
Modern vampire community, which is, on the Venn diagram of weird, it's over there with like the pagans and the New Agers and everything else. The modern vampire community has a number of people who identify as psychic vampires, who are aware of what they are, what they can do, and harness it like an energy worker harnesses, Reiki, Qigong, or anything else like that.
I know I've definitely had my fair share of energy vampires. What about you, Adam?
Yeah, there's definitely some people that I've met that I could definitely, before I heard you even talk about that concept, that kind of, you feel drained after you're with them. Yeah.
Well, and there's certain magical traditions and other traditions that teach people how to take that energy or how to harness it. And, you know, at the end of the day, when I do energy work on someone, I mean, I am a Reiki 3. I learned Reiki in order to compare it to what I naturally could do and get a better ability, language that other people would recognize so that I could explain, you know, what it was like for what I was doing. Because it's kind of like Reiki in reverse. You know, I can do it through a touch. I can do it at a distance, but I prefer to do it physically, in person, with a person who is willing, who understands what I'm doing, and can be an active participant, because in that case, it's not a negative experience, it's an exchange. And it can be used, the ability to take energy from someone can be used for healing. Some people have too much energy, some people don't have enough. If you find a good balance with somebody, it is a beneficial and a mutually beneficial exchange. It really ends up being a problem mainly if somebody's doing it to someone against their will, without their knowledge. It's an uninvited contact, and it often can have a very intrusive sensation if it's done against your will.
I'm a little guilty of it, practicing something like that myself in the past. Maybe not so much anymore. I kind of calmed down a little bit, but...
Oh, I wasn't always ethical about it, especially when I was younger, and I, on one hand, knew what I was doing, but on the other hand, didn't completely believe it, and so I would kind of experiment, and just sort of, I didn't take it as seriously as I should have, yeah. And so I had my fair share of things that I should not have done, and I kind of learned, in retrospect, to take it seriously, and to use it responsibly.
Right. Is there anything that you want to ask Luke before we...
Oh, I've got plenty more, but I guess it's about time to wrap up.
Yeah. Well, Michelle, I mean, you've been a great guest. This has been, like, really informative stuff. We've covered... I don't think we've even scraped the surface, like Luke says. He's got so many other questions. But what are you...
I'm always happy to talk more.
Absolutely. What are you working on now? You've got a few books out, but are you working on anything else that's coming out soon?
I'm working on two things. A lot of my fans of my nonfiction have asked for a follow-up to Haunting Experiences, which is a collection of real ghost stories, pretty much my personal experiences over time, and in a few cases, stories that were told to me by family of encounters, which try to tell a good, rousing ghost story that also happens to be true. So I'm collecting stuff from the past, 6 to 8 years, some of which is connected with my work with the Paranormal Research Society. And I'm also working on a fiction series, which I am hoping that I will have very good news about soon, because in addition to all the nonfiction stuff and the study that I do, I like telling stories. I love myth, I love folklore, I love the different ways that we can entertain one another even as we learn about these things. So hopefully there will be a little bit more news about that. And pretty much Haunting Experiences too, my book series. I finished work on a tarot a couple years ago, and just in a pretty good place with that, and also have been talking with Ryan and the gang about maybe getting back together with some more TV work.
Oh, okay.
I'm not thrilled. TV is, it's wonderful and it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's not something that I set out to be involved in. And I got on Paranormal State because I was friends with them. And as friends, they asked me to do the work in front of a camera that I might not have done if it was just, you know, some random person asking me. But as friends, they have asked again, and I don't think TV's done with me, I guess.
Cool, excellent. Michelle, where can everybody get your books?
Amazon carries everything, and I've written more than I can list here easily. So if you just go up onto Amazon and you put in my first and last name, you'll end up with 5 or 6 pages, because it's about 2 dozen books at this point.
Wow.
Damn.
I write a lot. You can look on my website. That's michellebelanger.com, and the last name is B-E-L-A-N-G-E-R. If you Twitter, and I Twitter, my Twitter is a little hard to find until you know my online handle, and that is Seth Anakim. S-E-T-H-A-N-I-K-E-E-M, Seth Anakim. And then I'm up on Facebook, and, you know, all the regular social media, my first and last name. And I think these days, if you just Google Michelle and Vampire, I will probably come up.
Gotcha. Well, Michelle, stay on the line. We're going to close out this section, and we'll be right back on Conspiranormal.
Okie doke.
Welcome back to Conspiranormal, and it has been enriched and enhanced by its wonderful co-host, who is now back on the scene.
That's right. Luke is back, everyone. That's amazing.
Woo! I almost didn't come tonight. I got so caught up in listening to shitty B-rate rap CDs that I forgot all about it.
That sounds like an excellent use of your time.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
So how's everything been?
Well, other than...
Fill everybody in on in the conspiranormal world.
Other than my ankle being jacked up, or... You know, this is the best season to skate and ride my bike and do things in nature, but my ankle's been jacked up for the past, like, month. So that's kind of put a definite halt on my life.
Is it feeling any better?
Yeah, I don't walk like I have Parkinson's as much anymore.
Yeah, you used to make fun of the guy you called a vulture.
Yeah, I was making fun of Vulture Guy for how he was walking around Hermitage, and now look at me, you know?
Well, it's great to have you back, man. What did you think of Michelle Belanger?
I wonder if she's single. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
I have no idea.
She's awesome, man. She knows her stuff, and I know anybody that's read, owns 3,000 books can... has a lot of answers to the questions that
I've
about
got a
occultism.
Lot of books, man, but I don't own that many, that's for sure. Told you I could get an occultist on eventually.
Right on. Yeah, I mean, my mom's got the same amount, but I don't think she's really read as much.
Well, it's all like Zachariah Sitchin books.
Well,
and stuff,
she's
right?
Got her New Age section, but she also has like the good stuff too. That right. She'll only let me borrow one book at a time because it's like her little hoarding, like TLC hoarder's treasure. Well, that she doesn't want to let go.
Sure. As we were mentioned in the interview with Michelle, you were reading this tome right now. You're reading about the Golden Dawn, which mm-hmm. I want to have you, you know, at some point. We'll do a whole show.
You're going to have to.
You and me.
Wait till I'm no longer a neophyte.
I'm just like, is there anything that stands out to you that you've, like, learned from that,
yep.
from that book?
Absolutely. I'm learning so much. Like, you know, at first I read the book on just the Kabbalah, and it explained the whole system of the Tree of Life and the Sephirah and the paths of the Sephiroth and everything, and what they mean, their numerical equivalents, and how math ties into the Kabbalah, and what the paths are for in everyday life, and then you've got this whole planetary influence and celestial body influence chart that influences specific times of the day when you'll be your most creative, or this is like she was talking about, the best time to apply for a new job, or the best time to go try to find a lover, and all of this is carefully and very specifically laid out in like a magical system.
Is there anything that you've tried in it?
No, I'm not ready. I'm just simply not ready. I need to read about 10 to 12 more books, and then you have to go through ritual dry run practices without a real weapon, is what they call it in occultism, or Western occultism, a weapon, which would be a wand or your sword or whatever that you've imbued, you know, with the energy for magical practice. So, yeah, I hadn't made it there yet. I got a lot to go.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, over the last couple of weeks, we've had on Micah Hanks, had on Paul Browning, a couple of guys that you remember Micah Hanks, because you probably would have been here for that one, but if he'd been able to do it on a Sunday, but he's only able to do it on a Monday.
Yeah.
We're going to actually try to get on his show at some point.
Okay.
So I'm looking at some time in November to try to get on there and you know, advertise our show a little bit more.
Right on.
But a little bit of a of an announcement to make. This actually will be our last show here in this, as I call it, studio, but it's actually a bedroom. Because I will be moving out because I'm getting a divorce. So, to announce that to everyone, and, you know, Duke's known about it for a while. Yeah. So.
Oh my God.
But
what?
Probably in about 3 weeks, we'll be at the new, I will call it the Hermitage Hills Studio.
He'll be in his bro cave, more like.
Yeah, my bro cave.
His bro command station.
Bro command station.
There's gonna be old vinyls laying everywhere, and empty craft beer bottles and old vinyls laying everywhere.
Yeah, I'd be like a total hipster. I'll just have a bunch of PBR bottles and listening to my vinyl.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that's about it, man. I think we can call it a night. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll be back in about 3 weeks or so to grace you with our presence. Don't know if we're going to have a guest. We may or may not. I'm going to have to get on to that.
We're going to have to use the Kabbalistic system, man, to get more listens on our show.
That's true. Yeah, you should do some magical intentions for us, buddy. Try to get that done for us. So, just want to thank everybody for listening to Conspiranormal. And, Luke, why don't you just take us out?
Yeah! Jedu takhle táboři, škodou sto na Oravu. Spěchám, proto riskuji, projíždím přes Moravu. Řádí tam to strašidlo, vystupuje z bážin, žere hlavně pražáky, jmenuje se Jožin. Jožin z bážin, močálem se blíží, Jožin z bážin, k vesnici se blíží. Jožin z bážin, už si zuby brousí, Jožin z bážin, kouše sa jerdousí. Na Jožina z bážin, koho by to napadlo, platí jen a pouze práškovací letadlo. Projížděl jsem dědinou, cestou na Vizovice, přivítal mě předseda, řek mi u Slívovice, živého či mrtvého, Jožina kdo přivede, tomu já dám za ženu, dceru a půl jezede. Jožin z bážin, močálem se blíží, Jožin z bážin, k vesnici se blíží. Jožin z bážin, už si zuby brousí, Jožin z bážin, kouše za jerdousí. Na Jožina z bážin, koho by to napadlo, platí jen a pouze prášku a světadlo. Říkám, dej mi předsedo, letadlo a prášek, Jožina ti přivedu, nevidím v tom háček. Předseda mi vyhověl, ráno jsem se vznesl, na Jožina z letadla prášek pěkně klesl. Jožin z bážin, už je celý bílý, Jožin z bážin, z močálu ven bílý. Jožin z bážin, dostal se na kámen, Jožin z bážin, tady je s ním amen. Jožina jsem dohnal, už održím, jo ho, dobré každé love, prodám já ho do zoo.